From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. On today's program, Cheryl Hyman, Chancellor of the City Colleges of Chicago, reveals how she's helping new graduates enter the workforce in the second part of our education series. Actress and comedian Phoebe Robinson discusses her new book, You Can't Touch My Hair, and Other Things I Still Have to Explain. And Hollywood legend Dick Van Dyke talks about his book, Keep Moving, and other tips and truths about living well longer. But first, it's well known that black voters have overwhelmingly supported the Democratic Party since the 1960s. According to the political website 538, Republican nominees have received, on average, 7% of the black vote since the passage of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. So what is political life like for black conservatives? According to my next guest, Professor Corey Fields, the relationship between black Republicans and their party of choice is complex. He wrote about his findings in a new book called Black Elephants in the Room, The Unexpected Politics of African-American Republicans. Professor Fields, good to have you on.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
Let me start here, mm-hmm. Which is, what did you learn about how these black Republicans, whoever they may be, reconcile their black identity with the Republican Party, its principles, and what it stands for, what it promulgates?
Right. I mean, the most interesting thing was that there was variation in that. There wasn't one way that they did it. So going into the project, you know, my impression of black Republicans was shaped just like most other people's, from like the people who you see on the news, the people who end up speaking at, you know, the convention, Republican convention kind of thing. And that tends to be one message, right? Sort of this sort of tough-talking black Republican who was saying, black folks, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, you know, sort of stop complaining about racism. So going into the project, that's what I was expecting, right, to get a lot of that and sort of hearing how people reconcile that. But surprisingly, actually, I found a lot of people who sort of talked about their Republican partisanship as sort of a form of pro-black politics, right? Mm-hmm. Sort of a black power through conservative principles kind of approach. And so for me, it was interesting to see, you know, these different strategies, right, sort of saying, I care about black people, but what's best for black people are conservative social policies, mm-hmm, versus, you know, the best thing for black people is to stop talking about race. Now, those two different approaches get very different responses within the party, right? And so, you know, if you're sort of race-conscious black Republican, you often find yourself marginalized, right? Even though you support the same policies as the rest of the party, and, you know, so you have a strategy for trying to get more black people involved, there's less interest in sort of promoting a message of sort of pro-black conservative politics. And so that's why our image of black Republicans so often ends up being someone who, you know, sort of sounds a lot like a white Republican.
You mentioned race conscious. Yeah. One of the things I learned from your text is that you discovered that there are really, at least you put them in two different categories, two different kinds of black Republicans.
Exactly.
One would be the race conscious black Republicans,
exactly,
that you referenced a moment ago,
right,
who don't get much love,
right,
inside the party.
Exactly.
Surprise, surprise. And the other group of black Republicans would be race blind.
Exactly.
Black Republicans. Tell me a bit more about the distinction between the two.
Yeah, I mean, big distinction between the two is sort of how they conceptualize the role of race and racism, mm-hmm, in structuring the black experience, right? For race-blind black Republicans, many will say, you know, there's an acknowledgement that racism is a real thing, but when you think about a sort of hierarchy, mm-hmm, of black people's problems, race-blind black Republicans will say, you know, racism isn't what's holding you back. It's your own, you know, sort of like inability to get with the program or, mm-hmm, your unwillingness to, you know, buckle down, right? They, mm-hmm, sort of isolate sort of individualist explanations or even sort of talk about cultural pathologies within the black community as being the locus of problems, mm-hmm, that black people face. And then they link that, right, these ideas about black people to conservative social policies, right? So the Republican Party makes sense because the Republican Party isn't interested in sort of racial identity politics, which, you know, I mean, as this latest election has shown, is not necessarily true, right? It's just that the racial politics the party doesn't seem interested in are sort of mostly focused on, you know, thinking about racial minorities,
yeah,
right? Sort of having those identities be prominent within the party.
Yeah. I thought to ask you, I'm still thinking to ask you, how these black Republicans today, mm-hmm, justify, explain, rationalize their support of a candidate like Donald Trump. But as I'm thinking to ask you that, I'm actually checking myself because I don't know that it's fair to ask how black Republicans can justify, you know, I'm going with this, right?
Right.
Any more than the white Republicans can justify Donald Trump. So
exactly.
is the question that I was about to ask an unfair question?
I would say it's a little bit unfair, right?
Yeah,
and this
yeah.
is something they sort of struggle with. And I definitely feel like one of the takeaways after doing the research was it's completely legitimate to look at a black Republican and say, why are you doing this? How are you doing this? I don't understand how you can support this kind of policy, right?
Yeah.
But I think you would have to ask those same questions of a white Republican, right?
Yeah.
Like, I feel like there isn't anything particularly especially unreasonable about a black Republican supporting Donald Trump any more than a white Republican supporting Donald Trump. But the reality is we do have expectations around sort of like how political preferences are supposed to manifest based on social identities like race. So I understand the question, and it makes a lot of sense, but I think, you know, in some ways, it's the same question we should be asking every Republican.
Yeah. So I take that. That's why I caught myself before I ask it. But I think what is...
But still.
But still, how do they justify
it? How do they do it? Right, exactly. No, completely reasonable. Completely reasonable. It's one of these things, right?
Right, you know.
I can say this all day, and I've been saying it all day in the book.
Yeah.
But it still is this open question of how do you do it, right? And the reality is a lot of them aren't doing it, right? You're seeing black Republicans sort of say, this is a bridge too far, right? I've stood by the Republican Party, and when a lot of people were calling me a sellout, a lot of people were calling me an Uncle Tom, and this is the repayment I get now, having to defend Donald Trump. And you see a lot of black Republicans sort of, you know, jumping ship. And
But I think what is fair, though, Corey, I think what is a legitimate question, not that that is illegitimate, but what is, I think, more legitimate, perhaps, is questioning how they support the party, because Trump is an individual. And as we all know, he's just upended the whole apple cart this time around. He's just the most unique nominee that party has ever put forth. So we all get that.
Right.
But there is a legitimate question, again, to be asked about how they support a party that advances policies that many of us see as antithetical to the best interest of black people. That ain't a Trump question. That's a GOP question.
Exactly. Okay. And I think part of the way they do that, right, is sort of reconfiguring how they think about black interests, right? So, I mean, I think one of the important takeaways from the book and one of the questions I want to raise from the book is, you know, how do we determine black interests, right? Like, we can talk about that as if it's a taken for granted or obvious thing, but that's a hotly contested question in itself, right? Even among black Republicans, there are fights over what, you know, how do we define black interests and what's good for black people. I think, you know, the way black Republicans themselves reconcile this is to sort of think about conservative social policies as promoting business, promoting family, right? And that these, you know, sort of very broadly speaking, become principles that will uplift the black community. Yeah. I think, you know, if we're being completely fair and honest about the black Republican experience, a lot of times it means standing behind the ideals while trying to disavow the current manifestation of those ideals. And that's, you know, something I saw in my research, something we're seeing in the current election, where there's this sense of, I'm a Republican, I believe in the ideals, even when the party doesn't stand up to them. And many of the black Republicans I studied, like, they aren't Republican ride or die, right? There'll be, you know, many white Republicans, they'll say, not this guy, but still want to hold on to the commitment to
them. One of the things I found fascinating, not surprising, but fascinating, is that the persons that you talk to when given an opportunity, as I understand from your writing, when given an opportunity to be either on the record or to be anonymous in their comment, they chose to be anonymous. What did you make of that? One way to read that is that they can be more freely in talking. The other way to read is that, you know, they're in the party, but a little bit too embarrassed to go on the record.
Right.
So which one is more accurate?
I think the former is probably more accurate, right? That this was sort of anonymity became a way to sort of open up full disclosure.
Right.
Because the experience of black Republicans within the party isn't particularly positive, right?
Yeah.
There was a lot of sort of complaining about being black within the party, feeling like you were sort of called on as like a racial token, right, to legitimate racist policies, right? And feeling like you aren't being heard when you want to articulate a pro-black agenda getting marginalized. So I think people wanted anonymity so they could talk freely and honestly, right? In some ways, you know, the being a black Republican, many of the activists I talked to, right, as they like being the outsider, right? For them, there's this sense of specialness of like, I see something no one else does, right? That you kind of get to have when you're engaged in this kind of unexpected politics. So, and for me, most of them were out to friends and family about their partisanship. So I think this was more, they're wanting to be anonymous, was more about not upsetting the apple cart within the party. Because it's a delicate dance they have to do.
Long term, the numbers of the percentage of black Republicans is going to be the same. Is it going to grow? Is it going to shrink? Where are we headed with black Republicans?
There seems to be no real reason to expect any sort of upward trend in it, right? I think, you know, I'd be surprised if this next, if the current election in a few weeks produces any bump in the number of black Republicans, right? The blacks voting for the Republican Party. I think what could happen is the sort of destabilizing effect of Trump on the Republican Party. What happens to the Republican Party after the election? Maybe we see a newly configured Republican Party that's sort of more moderate and temperate, right? Which then might open up things. So, but in a lot of ways, black Republicans are sort of, you know, I think capped partly because of the decisions of the Republican Party more broadly and where they're headed.
Well, you put your finger, I think, on the pulse of where we are, which is this question that everybody's wrestling with, which we will see in the coming months and years how it gets answered. But it is it's the penultimate question, I think, which is, what does the Republican Party do post Donald Trump? Whether he wins or loses, how do they reframe, reshape this party given the damage that's been done to it? And is that damage irreparable? I don't know the answer to those questions, but we'll be talking about it, trying to figure it out with people like Corey D. Fields, who's the author of the new book, Black Elephants in the Room, The Unexpected Politics of African American Republicans. Professor Fields, good to have you on.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Trying to find a job after college is a daunting process for many, but some institutions have created ways to help new graduates enter the workforce. Cheryl Hyman is the chancellor of City Colleges of Chicago. She launched a program called College to Careers with that city's mayor, Rahm Emanuel, back in 2011. The program helps graduates find jobs by collaborating with industry partners. Chancellor Hyman, thanks for coming on.
Thank you. Thanks for
having
me,
Tavis. This is an innovative program. I've been reading about it. I've been hearing about it. So tell me what y'all doing in Chicago.
So College to Careers, first of all, is part of a larger strategy that we call reinvention of City Colleges of Chicago. Mm-hmm. Why reinvention? When I came to City Colleges of Chicago in 2010, out of the 10 largest cities in the U.S., City Colleges was the ninth worst.
Wow.
Out of the, now we're at six.
Right.
And so
you're going in the right direction.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so we launched reinvention to turn some of that around, because obviously college education is critical to one's future. And so what we wanted to do is couple access with success. As you probably know, community colleges have been built on a paradigm of access, ensuring that students have access to a quality education, which is great. Right. We need to ensure, but we need to couple that with success. We need to define what success means and hold everybody accountable to it. So what we did at City Colleges, we came up with four goals and four strategies to support those goals. And our first goal was to ensure that more students receive credentials of economic value, meaning, Tavis, that when you come and invest your time and your money with us, every credential that you earn is either relevant in the workforce or it transfers to a four-year institution. And so in order to ensure that that happens, we wanted to focus on relevance. Relevance was our strategy. So what did we do? We did an 18-month study to figure out which jobs and which industries would dominate our region over the next decade. And we found that over the next decade, there would be more than 600,000 jobs in seven different industries alone in the Chicago region.
I see.
And so we have seven colleges at City Colleges of Chicago. So we created centers of excellence. So each one of our schools excels in each one of those
industries. So you match the skills with the needs.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We are very much living in a skill-based economy right now. And so we matched each one of our schools with each one of those industries: healthcare, IT, business, professional services, transportation, distribution, logistics, culinary, hospitality, advanced manufacturing. Some of the same jobs is dominating our region, right, is dominating in the U.S. right now. We then brought in industry partners in each one of those sectors to validate our data, validate our findings, and then work with our faculty and our administrators to totally reconstruct our curriculum to be relevant in those particular industries. And those partners also included four-year universities, because an associate's degree is also can lead to a bachelor's degree, and some of those credentials and jobs require a bachelor's degree, but getting your associate's degree first is very economical. And so now those partners, and we have over 200 industry partners representing all those sectors, now serve in an advisory capacity. They work with our faculty to reshape and rewrite our curriculum. They validate our data and our findings. They help us put those curriculums into pathways. They give our students internships and the first crack at job interviews. They're now starting to serve as teacher practitioners to help us teach some of those curriculums. And we've had almost 4,000 students to get jobs in those particular areas of study.
Well, nothing in life is guaranteed, but it's almost a guarantee if you have the skill set to match the need in the greater Chicago area, then it makes perfect sense that you would want to do that.
Nationally. This is why we have such a large skills gap, I believe, in the U.S., because there's a big skills to jobs mismatch. You know, I hear a lot, even if I'm in a grocery store and people recognize me and they walk up and say, you know, there's just no jobs and no one is hiring. That's simply not true. In our region alone, in healthcare, there's 84,000 jobs coming to our region over the next decade. In TDNL, there's 110,000 jobs. In business and professional services, there's almost 300,000 jobs. I have employers who tell me now this is the best model we could have implemented because they couldn't find a skilled workforce. In my manufacturing program alone, sometimes I have to tell the employers, let the student finish. They're trying to, you know, recruit the student before they even finish their curriculum. So, you know, we have this big skills gap, I think, in America, because we have a big gap in the way our educational systems are fundamentally set up and working.
I wonder to what extent the policymakers will start to get this. One, if not because of the success that you're having. Milwaukee is doing something a little bit similar to this. Not the same way you all are doing it in Chicago. But I was just taken aback by the success they're having in Milwaukee, matching again skill sets to the local economy. My question is, I wonder whether or not you think policymakers are ultimately going to get this, given that in this campaign, at least, I've seen more conversation about making two-year college affordable than any campaign in my life. Bernie Sanders talked about it. He pushed Hillary. Hillary's talking about it. So I wonder whether or not you think, and President Obama, of course, raised it in his second term. I wonder whether or not you think there's some momentum starting to build now that will get us to take these two-year colleges more seriously.
I think there is a lot of momentum that is building. There is a real job to employer shortage. There's a real skills to jobs mismatch that's happening. Everyone is talking about jobs. Everyone needs to work, and they're seeing this. We're seeing this in our nation. By 2020, Tavis, 60% of the jobs will require a post-secondary degree. And it's estimated that over the next 10 years, there will be 11 million skilled workers, a shortage of 11 million skilled workers. Everyone has to take this serious because we're seeing the effects of it in our nation. And so we've heard a lot about affordability. We certainly need to keep it college affordable. In Chicago, Mary Manuel and I launched a STAR scholarship, which gives free community college to students who are earning a B average in Chicago public schools and who test completion ready. So we certainly see a lot of momentum that is happening. We have a lot of good things that are happening out there, a lot of public-private partnerships. I think people are getting it. I think what we need now is models that have proven to work and that are scalable. And so models like College to Careers, models, other models mm-hmm. that you've seen, they are working. And I think this is what we need.
But they're only scalable. I saw the same thing in Milwaukee, and mm-hmm. I hear you say it now. So they're only scalable, though, to the extent that you have the resources.
Exactly.
When I think about a place like Chicago, mm-hmm. one doesn't need to live in Chicago. I don't. I love Chicago, but I don't live there. Mm-hmm. But I read enough to know that Chicago is one of those cities Rahm Emanuel's fighting, trying to balance that budget.
That's right.
You all are appealing to the state for more money. I'm out here, but I'm checking out what's going on
exactly.
in Chicago. So I know that mm-hmm. when you're trying to meet budget, mm-hmm. oftentimes programs that are geared towards students of color are
exactly.
the first ones to get cut. Exactly. So how is it scalable if you don't have the resources to make
right.
it grow?
So I would challenge us to we certainly have financial pressures.
Sure.
I have seen the financial pressures of the state budget impasse that we're having. We see financial pressures all over this country. However, we cannot allow those financial pressures to allow us not to do what we need to do to educate the students who are coming through mm-hmm. our doors. I would challenge Tavis that a lot of times we think we need more resources when a lot of times we really need to be more resourceful.
Uh-huh.
And so
I hear the distinction.
And I would challenge let's look at being more resourceful. When you be deliberate about the goals and the outcomes that you're trying to achieve, then you can make deliberate investments. You can make deliberate investments in your capital. You can make deliberate investments in your programs. I think typically with community colleges, we were making a mistake of trying to be everything to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
That's when you need a lot of resources.
Sure, sure.
But when you're deliberate and you're saying, okay, I'm preparing the workforce for what's coming to my region over the next decade, and I'm being very deliberate about what I offer and what my goal is,
yeah.
then I think you'll find that you have quite a few resources at your disposal. When I launched Reinvention, one of the things I looked at too is how are we operating? Where are we investing our money? Are we investing our money in a strategy geared towards a model like College
yeah.
to Careers? And I was able to save $70 million. When I started to be more deliberate about what
but
our mission
but
was.
But I also get the sense, though, Cheryl, that you're going to need those resources.
You will.
Primarily because four-year degrees, you know,
mm-hmm.
you know where I'm going with this,
right.
are less and less affordable.
Mm-hmm.
Students have to, as we say, get in where they fit in.
Mm-hmm.
And if a two-year degree puts you on the path to getting
mm-hmm.
a good-paying job in Chicago or wherever else
mm-hmm.
you might live, you have a lot more butts to put in seats.
You do.
Yeah.
You do have to be more resourceful. That's why with that $70 million, when we became very strategic with our four goals and our four strategies, I was able to invest in things like more advisors.
Mm-hmm.
When I started at City Colleges of Chicago, our average student to advisor ratio was as high as 1,300 to 1. So who was really getting good
yeah,
advisement?
Sure.
And so now it's as low as 250 to 1. I was
right.
able to make those strategic investments. And so you will need more resources. I was able to open up wellness centers across all of our campuses because a lot of times we think what holds students back is what happens outside. What happens inside mm-hmm. the classroom, but a lot of times it's the social emotional issues that they're dealing with, and you need to invest in that too. So we invested in wellness centers. So you do need those resources. However, when you have a very specific strategy, you know exactly what resources you need to invest in.
Yeah. The program is called College to Careers, City Colleges of Chicago. If you want to look it up and read more about it, one of the things we try to do on this program as often as we can is to showcase conversations that work, mm-hmm. projects that are working, and to Cheryl's point, programs that ought to, in fact, be scaled up. Thank you for your work, Cheryl. Good to have you on the program.
Thank you.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Phoebe Robinson is an actress, comedian, and podcaster whose new book about being black and female in America is called You Can't Touch My Hair. I love it. And other things I still have to explain. Phoebe, good to have you on the program.
Thanks for having me. I'm so excited.
I'm glad to have you. I suspect that you must be getting recognized a bit more these days. How are you handling people recognizing that face?
It's been good. Everyone's been really nice. Yeah. I'm still getting my hair touched a lot, which is annoying. I was staying in a hotel, and I was in the hotel lobby on a phone call with a friend, and this white lady was walking over, and she was smiling at me like she knew me, so I'm like, oh, it's probably from Two Dope Queens. She listens to the podcast. She wasn't saying anything. She's like, I know you're on the phone, but I just want to say you're really pretty. And I was like, thank you so much. It's so nice. I'm wearing sweatpants and no makeup. This is a struggle look for me, but I appreciate it. And then she just kept like pacing back and forth and hovering. And then she came over and just started petting my hair and just being like, you're so pretty. And I was like, okay. And then she went to the bathroom. Yeah. So that's still happening. Even though I wrote the book, people still like, let me get that for a test drive.
So I think most of us who have been black our whole lives kind of understand this. Mm-hmm. But explain to the audience why this is an issue, why it is such an annoyance, however you want to explain it.
Yeah, I think just historically speaking, black hair has been very controversial for this country.
Yeah.
A lot of people don't understand our hair, don't want to understand our hair, and it's not seen as beautiful or professional unless it's on a white model like Marc Jacobs with the dreadlocks during Fashion Week. And there's a lot of curiosity that tends to happen, so people just want to touch and grab.
Yeah.
And there's just doing that, for me, just doesn't feel comfortable. It's just it's a violation of my space in my body, and I feel a lot of times people just don't respect black women's bodies, and that's why the hair is just like, I'll just grab it because I think it's cute, and it's like, okay, but I'm a person, ask permission.
It is such a serious issue, and yet what comedians at their best do, as you know, is to find the comedy in it. So tell me how you take an issue that seriously and then make it like funny.
Well, the thing is, I've changed my hair all the time. Like on the cover, I have the fro.
Right.
This is like a low budget Beyonce situation right now.
I like this, a low budget Beyonce situation.
And then for a while, I had braids, and I was staying with friends in LA when I came out, I think, to audition for something I didn't get. And I was staying with friends, and Dan, the husband, was there, and he was on a phone call. And, you know, black hair, we have a weave in or braids, and your hair, your real hair pushes the fake hair out. And so I got up to go to the kitchen, and just one braid fell out of my hair onto the ground. And then their dog, Dennis, started eating it. And so Dan had to dive in and take this braid out of the dog's mouth. And that was a really, like, he was just very cool. He was an ally then. He didn't question. He was just like, there's a braid that needs to be rescued. Here you go. So I think in those moments where I can have fun with black hair and make it something accessible for people, I want to share in that because, you know, you want to laugh. You want to feel good. I don't want this to be like a tough history lesson about black hair and about, you know, black feminism. Like, I want people to have fun when they're reading the book.
There is this old adage, I think, that many of us, I certainly believe in, which is that, certainly being black, we know this, that at times, this is true for us and certainly true for our ancestors, that at times, if they didn't laugh, they'd cry. Sometimes you laugh to keep from crying. It is interesting to me because as a black woman, there potentially are so many things to be angry about. And yet it seems to me that you have to choose to laugh. You have to choose to find the humor in it. Just tell me about your journey trying to navigate every day being a black woman and choosing not to be angry about this insult or that, you know, put aside, but just taking it and kind of flipping it, essentially.
Well, I think I've been doing stand-up for a little over 8 years, and that is a very male, white male in particular, dominated industry.
I love that. Was so many.
Yes, so many white guys is one of my podcasts.
I love that podcast. Yeah. So many white guys.
Thank you so much. Which a lot of white guys got mad about, but I'm like, just listen to the podcast. It's woke. You'll learn something.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of times where, for instance, like if I do a stand-up show, they will only want to book one woman because they don't want it to feel like a weird specialty show if we have more than one woman on.
Yeah.
So you have those kind of situations that you just encounter all the time that I don't think people realize how belittling it is and like how much it's kind of pushing people aside. And so it can be tough at times, but I think doing stand-up and just I'm just going to make sure I'm the funniest that I can be. That's all I can control. I can't control if someone's going to discriminate because I'm a black woman. I can control being the best person in the lineup. So that's what I try and do.
Yeah. You mentioned the podcast. You got a couple of these things. Tell me about, for those, I mean, most of us, or many of us certainly have come to appreciate, and we do the podcast thing. A lot of people are still trying to figure out what that is. How do I find it? Why would I want to listen? Just give me a quick lesson here on how you've been able to use podcasts to advance your career and what you actually do with your podcast?
Well, I have two podcasts with WNYC, Two Dope Queens that I co-host with Jessica Williams, and then so many.
Well, you wrote the forward to this book.
Yeah, she did. It was a lovely forward. Right. And then my solo.
What's that term you call her? Your wife? Your
my work wife.
My work wife.
Yeah, she's great.
Jessica Williams is your work wife. Yeah. I love it. Okay, I'm sorry. Go ahead. Yeah.
And then the other one's an interview show, So Many White Guys. Yeah. And I think with both podcasts, Jess and I, working together and also separately, like, we wanted to highlight voices that we felt were marginalized and, like, not represented. A lot of times, stand-up comics and storytellers of color, women, and people from the LGBTQ plus community don't get the platforms to be funny. And so with Two Dope Queens, we were just like, we're going to highlight that. And then, sure, we'll have some white guys on, but we really want to showcase these brilliant, amazing people who are fantastic. And then I do the same thing with the interview show. Like, I had on Janet Mock, who's amazing, and Gina Rodriguez. And, you know, I just have really smart conversations with Saa Minaj, like, just great conversations with amazing people that I feel like a lot of times when they're interviewed, it's like, Hassan, so you're brown. Yeah. What's it like to be brown in Hollywood? And it's like, well, that's not all that he is. It's not his skin color. So I want to have real conversations with people without making them the other.
Yeah. To that not being all that Hassan is, do you ever feel like, back to your hair, that for you and for other black women, you get reduced to your hair?
Yes.
I'm thinking of that India Arie song, I Am Not My Hair.
Yeah. I love that song growing up. And I do, I feel there, in a certain way, black women can't do anything right.
Yeah.
Because, you know, when I normally wear my hair, it's normally an afro. It's kind of like a Frederick Douglass moment. It's like a little bit like wild and big.
So kind of like Frederica Douglass?
Yeah. It's okay, like, it's dope and awesome. And then, you know, people would be like, oh, she would be prettier if her hair was straight.
Yeah.
And if I throw in like a summer look like this, and it's like, okay, well, how can she talk about black issues if her hair is straight? So I think there's for me, I want to take black hair back. I want black women to own it. And the only way that I feel that I can do is by having fun with it and wearing my hair however I want and telling people that doesn't define who I am as a person. That doesn't mean that I'm not smart.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean that I don't love myself. And you can't tell me how I feel about myself based on my hair.
Yeah. You were seriously getting your hustle on because you're acting as well.
Yeah.
So tell me how the acting is coming along.
The acting's been good. I did a small role in Broad City on Comedy Central. And now I'm working on a new Amazon show that Jill Soloway is directing. It's really, really great.
I talk to so many young people, and I know so many young people and run into young people who are always looking for some lessons about how to navigate the journey that they're on. I mean, trying to find your way to success isn't easy for any of us, and there is no one-size-fits-all. But certainly people of color are always trying to figure out, how do I navigate from here to here? And I get more letters, and I have more young people come to speeches. They wait for the Q&A, because everybody wants to get a piece of your time. Yeah. You just got to figure out, to help them figure out how to navigate the journey. What are you learning about the journey?
I think it's hard for people of color, I 2014 was a really hard year. I couldn't get hired on anything, writing or performing, and I really wanted to quit. That was like a really hard year. I quit my day job to work on this pilot that didn't go, so I was just freelance writing and doing unpaid stand-up gigs, and I was really like, this is too hard. I called my parents, and I was like, I'm quitting, and they told me not to quit, and I think having that really tough year of like nothing going right. And then now 2 years later, I have a book and these podcasts and all this stuff. I would just tell people that it is going to be super hard. And you might feel like people aren't helping you because you are a person of color. So surround yourself with amazing people like Jessica Williams, or, you know, I just think that having this sisterhood, in particular, if you're a black woman, like, because there's not a lot of us.
Yeah.
So I think just having those deep bonds with people really helps. And then also you just have to work hard. It's really, this industry, it's not going to happen on your timeline. It never does. So you just have to remember you got into it because you love it, and you're not going to make money for a really long time, and you're going to have to be okay with that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One of the reasons why I asked that question of you is because what you did, Phoebe, was to exercise your own agency. So you're right about the fact that it doesn't happen on your timeline. You're not going to make any money at the beginning. But it's one of those things where you have taken control of the reins of your own future. I mean, you wrote your book and you started your podcast.
Yeah.
And I think that what is available in today's era that wasn't available perhaps for many of us years before was the ability to do that mm-hmm. because you can self-publish, because you can go and start your own podcast, because you can blog. And I find that sometimes people are looking for you to give them a map. And what it really boils down to oftentimes is doing what Phoebe did, which is to sort of just chart your own course.
Yeah, and it's really hard because this industry is like you're either the pretty one or you're the funny one. You're either the sloppy one or you're like the neat type A.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, most people are not just one thing.
Yeah.
And I noticed when I was auditioning a lot, it was either I was always the best friend of the girl who had the love life. I was never a romantic interest.
Yeah.
Or it was I was doing these like fried food commercials where it's like, girl, girl. And I have to go in and be like, why am I doing this, Philip and Octavia?
Because you do it really good. That's why. You do it so well. That's why. Yeah.
My parents are going to be like, girl. And I really just got to, I got to a place where I was like, this is not who I am. Yes, I am black, but like I listen to you too, and I'm obsessed with Oprah, and I run the gamut of pop culture stuff, and I also care about feminism, and I was like, well, maybe I should just kind of define for myself who I am and just kind of just do my own thing, and hopefully people will gravitate towards me, and I think that's really worked out.
Her name is Phoebe Robinson. Her book is called You Can't Touch My Hair and Other Things I Still Have to Explain. From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. My next guest is the beloved Hollywood icon and multiple award-winning performer, Dick Van Dyke. Mr. Van Dyke is also a writer. His New York Times bestselling book called Keep Moving and Other Tips and Truths About Living Well Longer was just released in paperback earlier this month. Mr. Van Dyke, welcome back to this program. Apparently, you're still moving. you're still moving.
I got here.
When I saw you last, we had just a bit of an occasion to talk about politics.
Yes.
And I know your book is out. Maybe we'll talk a bit about that.
Well.
But being so close to Election Day, I want to check back in with you to see what you have made of this season that we have had to endure.
Well, I wanted to first say you were the catalyst that allowed me to meet Bernie Sanders and to introduce him at the Coliseum and Santa Barbara. Everywhere.
So you met him after you left here?
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
So I went to Reno for him and got to know him. What a wonderful man.
I'm sure he appreciated that.
Oh, yeah.
So let me ask you right quick then. We'll start there then. What do you make of what he was able to accomplish in his campaign?
With the millennials.
Yeah.
He did great.
Yeah.
And I hope they all get out and vote anyway. He kept saying to me, get me some old votes.
Yeah.
Get me some old votes. He thought I was going to be the...
That's funny. The old guy had the young votes, but he needed some old votes.
That's right.
Bring out Dick Van Dyke.
He was like 20 years younger than I am.
So I
like to give young politicians a little hand up.
Yeah.
But you know, back last spring, I did a little tweet asking people to listen to his message. I didn't ask anybody to vote for him, but I said what he has to say is important. I got emails back, mostly angry ones, from people who like Trump.
Yeah.
But not one intelligent debate. Somebody said, socialism, have you forgotten Hitler and Stalin? That was the smartest thing.
That's the smartest thing you got.
Right.
When you have been and are still so beloved by the American public because of what you have done with your artistic genius, how do you feel when you put something out and people respond to you, Dick Van Dyke, in an ugly, nasty way?
Well, it was only a few. Most people, said, liked what I said.
Yeah.
But there's always a few.
Yeah.
The thing about Trump is he's a dime a dozen. If without his father, he would have been a used car salesman.
Mm-hmm.
But what's disappointing, there are millions of people who share his paranoia and his anger and his hatred. That's what bothers me. It really sounds like the dumbing down of America to me.
Yeah.
I've talked to Republicans who will vote for him, despite the fact they say he's not fit to be president, but because they're Republicans.
Mm.
And there was an evangelist on the other day who rationalized himself right into the bathroom.
Yeah.
He said, well, we're all sinners. It's just a matter of degree. situation.
Yeah.
How about that?
That's the part that is the part that troubles me most, that in his word and in his deed, he has been so anti-Christian.
Ooh.
And yet these Christians are lining up, these conservative Christians are lining up to support him.
They're rationalizing it.
What do you make of that?
Along party lines, and as he says, we're all sinners, so he's a little worse than the rest of us. But I just don't, I can't buy, I talk to so many people who aren't going to vote or who are going to vote for, a third party.
Right.
And this is not just the lesser of two evils.
Yeah.
He has to be stopped.
Yeah.
Apparently he's going to dissolve the Senate and the House and run things like Mussolini did.
Yeah.
The shackles are off.
Yeah.
Some of the people I talk to, I get the impression that there's kind of a fuzzy line for them between the Constitution and the Bible.
Mm.
The quotes are intermixed. They don't. It's very strange.
Yeah.
They interviewed some people who didn't know what the three branches of government were.
Since you were such an avid Bernie Sanders supporter, what do you say to those millennials and others who still haven't quite made the turn yet to support Hillary Clinton?
Well, as I said, this is not another one of those lesser than two evils. We've already been through that. I think we have to stop a man who wants to be the dictator.
Mm-hmm.
I think we'll be in a war within a month after he's in office. It bothers me that people can't read him. And it's all rigged. There is one thing about rigging that I noticed. I was on CNN. I did a short live interview about Bernie.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of it, they said it didn't get on the air. And I said, what happened? They said, well, Trump did something stupid. I said, well, are they going to run it later? They said, probably not.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody saw it at 1:30 in the morning. And I told Bernie how I got sidelined. He says, you don't know the half of it. Had he been taken off, sidelined, edited? I think the DNC was responsible for that. Mm-hmm. So there is some hands.
You're hitting on something now that I have talked about in terms of full disclosure. I've raised this issue a number of times and have caught a bit of hell myself for saying this because I'm a part of the media, but I think it's a truth that ought to be spoken. I have said that it's beyond annoying. It's more than just laughable. It's offensive and insulting to me to watch the way my own profession was, to my mind, complicit in helping to make Donald Trump.
Yes.
And now they're fawning over each other to condemn Donald Trump. So the complicity has morphed into condemnation, but it took all this time to make that happen. So since you made this comment about CNN, how they kind of bumped you for Trump because he was live doing something else, what's your sense of the role the media has played in making, creating, building up Donald Trump?
Pandering.
Yeah.
It's pandering.
Mm-hmm.
I was at CBS in the 60s
mm-hmm.
when the news department was a separate entity.
Mm-hmm.
Ratings did not count.
Mm-hmm.
You were supposed to get the information out to the people.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's part of the amusement, mm-hmm. and they pander. They give you the news that they think you will watch.
Mm-hmm.
Scandal and those kinds of things. And you don't get any straight news.
Yeah,
it's frightening.
Yeah. What is it, to your mind at least, that Donald Trump is appealing to in these voters that are supporting him? What's he appealing to? What's making it work?
It's their anger.
Yeah.
There's a lot of angry people, of course, the way things are going. But, I mean, things are bad enough in the world situation without a paranoid idiot at the head of the country.
Mm-hmm.
It's their anger. He's talking the way they talk, locker room talk.
Mm-hmm.
He likes they like his attitude. I'm going to run everybody out of the country. I'm going to build a wall.
Yeah.
Things he can't do.
Yeah.
I think the Republicans just think they'll be able to control him.
Yeah.
That the House and the Senate, and they'll be able to steer. It is so such a bare exposure of the greed and the lust for power. You can see it.
Yeah.
And Republican senators and people who have, are supporting him.
Yeah, yeah.
For no other reason than it's power.
There are two questions that I don't know the answer to. Maybe you do, but I keep wrestling with them. I keep noodling with them. One question is, what happens to the Republican Party post Donald Trump? How do they
fix this?
I don't know.
Yeah.
They won't have nobody's respect or trust anymore, I don't think.
Yeah.
That was very interesting. It depends on whether he wins or loses.
What do you make of the fact that nothing he has done, not the optics of the way it looks in a debate, not the antics of his behavior, what do you make of the fact that none of that has knocked him out as yet?
I don't know. Yeah, no one knows.
Yeah.
It just doesn't make any sense to me. It's one thing. He said it was locker talk. He revealed who he was.
Mm-hmm.
We all know guys like that.
Mm-hmm.
I know them.
Mm-hmm.
I see them. I don't know them, and I don't like them.
Mm-hmm.
But he attacks other people in the public eye
right.
who've had affairs. That's different. A person can have an affair, but he attacks aggressively. Have you seen some of the T-shirts?
I've seen them, yeah. Yeah.
It really is so...
There's
troglodytes out there.
Do you think his behavior in this campaign has caused irreparable damage to the process of electing a president? In other words, can this thing get reeled back in, or has he pushed the envelope off the table, out the door, down the sidewalk?
I think you're right. I think he has.
Yeah.
I think he has. We've been trying to get rid of the Electoral College forever.
Yeah.
Or Al would be a president.
Yeah.
He won the popular vote.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it's going to stay this way for a long time. Political incorrectness is just being animal, beast-like. That's all it is.
Yeah.
They used to say the good manners were kind of the lubrication and help society.
Yeah.
You think back to the people like Pat Moynihan and Tip O'Neill as some of the statesmen that were, there are no statesmen anymore.
Yeah.
They just don't exist. I remember Bill Buckley, who had that wonderful show Firing Line.
Sure.
I seldom agreed with him, but I had such respect for his intelligence, his integrity, and he always made a good point. Those people don't exist anymore.
Yeah. How does Dick Van Dyke, in his 90th plus year of living...
91 in December.
91 in December. How do you process seeing this in your country at this stage of your life? How did you process?
People accuse me of, looking through rose-colored glasses and having nostalgia. But a lot of babies have gone out with the bathwater.
Yeah.
Trust is something that doesn't exist anymore.
Mm-hmm.
To be a trustworthy person is something to be valued.
Yeah.
I'm to the place where I would rather be hurt a few times than be paranoid.
Mm-hmm.
I'd rather be trusting, despite the fact that it's going to cost me. There were two organizations back in the 50s, Planned Parenthood and Zero Population Growth,
mm-hmm.
which accurately predicted the gridlock that we're all in today. They told us it was going to happen, and it happened. And now all of a sudden, I think technology has escalated beyond human beings' ability to control it.
Yeah.
I really do.
Yeah.
I was in a lot of trouble.
Yeah. The new book from Dick Van Dyke, despite everything you've heard, is his advice to you: keep moving.
I had a title. I wanted to say what to do while circling the drain.
Yeah.
and the publisher didn't like.
Yeah, I'm glad they went with keep moving.
No sense of humor.
Yeah, I'm glad they went with keep moving. I like. You can catch me weeknights on my television show on PBS. For more info on what I'm doing or to hear this show, past shows, or the Tavis Smiley Show podcast, visit TavisSmileyRadio.com. The Tavis Smiley Show is a news and opinion program produced and recorded in Los Angeles by SRP Productions in partnership with Public Radio International. Christabel N.C. Abwadi is our executive producer. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is PRI. Keep the faith.